when I discovered 100 Merry Tales, it was as if I discovered that I had a slightly batty old uncle that used to sit in his chair and kind of tell stories. The rambling story is quite funny. And then a bit later on, you learn that he was born in the Middle Ages. And, oh, yes, well, that's fair enough.
Hello, I'm Robert Crichton, General Overseer of the Beyond Shakespeare podcast, and I'm delighted to present for you this episode discussing, less specifically plays or drama, but one of the big influences of early modern theatre. Today I'm talking with John Thorpe Ewing, editor of a new edition of the 100 Merry Tales. It's a jest book published in the 1520s by John Rastall. John Rastall was the first printer of plays, and we owe him for giving us copies of many early 16th century plays that would never have survived without him. As you're about to hear, he also had fingers in a whole host of other pies. He not only printed plays, but he also wrote them. But more on that later. Firstly, I spoke with John about John Rastall, his early life, and the book we're primarily focusing on today, his 100 Merry Tales. So, there's an exciting account of the detective work done with the various editions of this text, how they were put together, and crucially, how many tales there are in the 100 Merry Tales. The answer may surprise you. So, John Rastall, or is it John Rastall? Is there a consensus on pronunciation?
I would always say Rastall. I kind of guess that it's like a lot of these names, you know, there's a tendency when you see a double L on the end of something nowadays, I think, to make it sort of sound a bit French. But there are lots of names like that in English, and I think they would in his day, I'm fairly sure, have been stressed on the first syllable.
Yeah.
People will have their own opinions, but mine is definitely with Rastall.
Rastall. Shall we briefly just tell us about John Rastall, about who he was and a little bit of his life up to, shall we say, this point?
Yes, well, John Rastall was a fascinating person, really. He's one of those people that you dig up in Tudor history and you think, well, why don't we all know more about him?
Mm.
Because he was an important lawyer, he was a publisher, he was an explorer, he was a playwright.
Mm.
He was a painter. He worked with Holbein. He built the first theatre, purpose-built theatre for public use. And so, you know, he's a very interesting chap. He came from Coventry, and his father was coroner of Coventry. And after John Rastall had been down to London to study the Inner Temple, but he studied law in London, and then he came back up and he succeeded his father as coroner of Coventry. And Rastall married the sister of Sir Thomas More, so he was probably always relatively well connected, but obviously the Mores were better connected, and Thomas More ended up as Henry VIII's Chancellor, and so this was a really significant connection for Rastall. But I think More also was keen to be part of Rastall's enterprise too. And so Rastall's first publication that we know of was actually a translation by Thomas More of the life of John Picus. So, you know, there was a sort of family thing going on there as well. And Rastall was able to help More, and More was able to help Rastall.
And More had a fair interest in performance as well himself. So there's all these little overlaps.
Yes, indeed. Yes. And so, I mean, it's one of these things where you have a group of people who are obviously sharing interests, supporting each other, and, you know, it's a bunch of friends, and they're all interested in the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit like in more modern times, maybe the Bloomsbury Group, where they all sort of propel each other forwards. And More is the main name from England that we know about in that group today.
Mm.
But Rastall was there too, and he was, you know, he was also significant in his own right.
Yes, it all gets much more complicated the closer we get to the Reformation.
Yes, it gets very complicated with the Reformation. But In 1525,
yes,
and 100 Merry Tales, the first edition, is dated by Devereux to 1524 or 1525. It, at that date, when 100 Merry Tales is published, we're before the Reformation.
Yes.
So it's a sort of, and this is something else that I think is really interesting and really significant for 100 Merry Tales. It comes into a sort of golden age for England. And I think that when people from Elizabethan times looked back at 100 Merry Tales, one of the things they were looking back on is this idyll where you have what to them appear to be perfectly happy people who have solved the dynastic problems of the 15th century, but haven't yet got into the religious problems of the 16th century.
Mm.
And it's just this sort of merry playground with fat friars and all sorts of absurd things going on.
Yes.
From an Elizabethan perspective, I think that was the attraction of the Merry Tales, and they really did enjoy 100 Merry Tales. Queen Elizabeth had it read to her on her deathbed. And there are 14 references to it from the late Elizabethan period. So I think that it became a tremendously important book in the late 1500s.
So what drew you to the Merry Tales?
I was in Newcastle Public Library about 20 years ago, and I saw this book on the shelf, which was, I think it had a slightly difficult to interpret title. I think it said Assi Merry Tales on it, and I thought, what on earth is that? And I recognised that it must be some form of either Middle English or early modern English, and pulled it down and started reading. And was delighted with it, in fact. And I've kind of been interested in that ever since. So, yes, it's something that I just found charming and difficult not to be interested in. And I kind of went round all my friends quoting various tales at them, so much to their bemusement, I think. most of the stories are not actually sort of, most of them are not laugh-out-loud funny, but they're quite amusing, I think, and often very charming.
So how did you come about to edit a new edition?
Well, I'd been looking at the tales for a long time and, you know, sort of on and off returning to them. It occurred to me that there was a certain amount of disagreement. There'd been no proper work done on them since the 1800s. No one had really looked seriously at what was going on. So things had been left with a sort of argument between two sides of... there were two different editions that people had drawn attention to, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one edition, which was the first that was found, and that was an incomplete edition. It had been used as pasteboard. Two copies of the same edition had been stuck together and used as pasteboard in another book. So it was incomplete. There were bits missing. And then another copy had been found in Germany, which was complete, but it was also different. So there were tales that were added in the complete edition that weren't in the, and obviously had never been in the earlier edition which had been found. So there was an argument as to which of them was the original edition. They were both obviously from the 1520s. The complete edition dated to 1526. The man who discovered the complete edition argued that his was the right one. His was the first edition, and therefore, because it was first, that was, you know, first and complete, you can forget about the other. But there was never any real certainty, and a new edition of the other copy came out by William Carew Hazlitt, and he obviously didn't go along with Oesterle's estimation that his complete edition was the first. So the complete edition is dated 1526. Mm-hmm. I think it's the 22nd of November, 1526. And most people basically accepted the idea that it was probably the first, and it sort of became the standard edition because it was complete, probably the first edition, and so 1526 became the accepted date for the publication of 100 Merry Tales. But then in 1999... there was a book published which more or less proved that it couldn't printing block, which is broken in the 1526 edition and is not broken in the other edition.
I do love this level of, because it's we have this forensic evidence.
Yeah, it's perfect, isn't it?
Mm.
Because, and it's the sort of thing that, I mean, I would never have thought of looking at
no.
wood blocks in it. And the person that was doing it, Devereux, he spotted this. He was doing a bibliography of all Rastall's books, and so he was able to spot these things, because that's the sort of thing that he was looking at. And so he wanted to get them all in order, and he was looking for all the clues that there are in that. I also realised that there are two other editions of the book which have never really been drawn on, and they are later editions, and they're not from Rastall's own press. So there's one which I was able to get hold of a facsimile copy of, which is printed in 1603 in
right.
Edinburgh, and it doesn't have all the tales. But what's really nice about it is that it fills in all the gaps from the tales that are incomplete in the original copy. So there are some tales that are not in the 1526 edition and only survive in fragments in the copy that we have from the first edition. But all of them, by chance, are in this 1603 edition. And then there's another edition of which a few pages survive in Cambridge University Library, and that was probably printed around 1548 mm-hmm. by Robert Copland. So that also is an important source of evidence. They both agree, so both the later editions agree on tales that are sort of not in the second edition, but are in the first edition. And there's quite a few signs that you can pull out of them that seem to suggest that there must have been a kind of standard version that was neither the first edition that we have nor the second edition. And almost certainly, it seems to me, Rastall will have printed a third edition. He may have printed several editions, in
yes.
fact.
It's that problem we have, that there's so much data we are potentially missing.
No, well, I was actually quite delighted with what evidence there is, because I think there's enough evidence that you can kind of put together a story that is, you know, there may be details that are not quite right, but it basically got to be more or less right. You know, I reached a point where I had convinced myself, and obviously, you know, other minds will come to it with different perspectives.
I'm sure they will.
You know, I tried to approach it critically, and I came to what seems to me to be a reasoned conclusion. That's the sort of technical publication history stuff, that it doesn't quite allow you to create a stemma. There are too many gaps, but
no.
there are enough, you get enough sort of bits of picture that you can create a whole picture. And so my edition of 100 Merry Tales has 103 tales in it.
I was going to say, how many tales are there in 100 Merry Tales? The answer may surprise you. If I was going for a clickbait article, that's probably how I would phrase it. So there are 103.
Yes. There are, in fact, 103. The first edition, and this is why I think it ended up as pasteboard in the covers of other books, the first edition only had 99 tales. And there it was on the cover, or the title page or whatever, it says 100 Merry Tales. And there are only 99 tales in the book. And Rastall, of course, is a lawyer.
Yes.
He has a great belief in sort of the common weal. And I think he must have, when someone pointed that out to him, he must have thought, oh, no. And just pulped, well, not pulped, but, you know, turned them into pasteboard with everything he had left in stock and reprinted. And so the reprint, I think, is the one that was published on the 22nd of November, 1526. And he didn't prepare that one himself, or his usual compositor, Thomas Keel, didn't prepare it. It was Peter Treveris. I don't know how to say that name, actually. Is it Treveris or is it Trevor? Because it seems that if you say it Treveris, then he sounds like a very kind of, you know, he sounds quite exotic.
Yeah.
And people say, oh, is he from Cornwall? So, you know, the beginning, or is he from Trier?
Mm.
Which would, you know, Treveris could be of Trier.
Mm.
But if you say it Trevers,
yeah,
then it's just a standard English name, isn't
yes.
it? So anyway,
yes.
he did the new edition. I think it's interesting that he basically included the same tales in the same order, mm. but made changes. So there are accidental changes.
Mm.
He spells it in his own style,
mm-hmm.
Which is noticeably different from the spelling of the first edition. But then there are these extra tales that he puts in,
mm.
and he doesn't just print the 99 with one extra.
Mm.
He puts in four tales and drops three.
Right.
And the tales are all in the same style.
Mm.
So he's obviously not making up these extra tales.
No.
He's drawing them from the same place that that the first 99 came from. So my feeling is that Rastel must have had a book with all these stories written in it.
Mm.
And they must have been basically in order. So this brings us on to authorship.
Yes, because that's, mm-hmm. That's a game that people love to play. Are you content to say that it's by Rastel, or you
yes.
think there are other hands in there?
No, I think it's by Rastel. I think there's really no other explanation makes sense to me. I think it's fairly clear that Rastel must have had a manuscript with all these stories in it, told in the same words that we used in the book,
mm.
in the printed book. And it doesn't really seem logical to imagine that that manuscript would have been written by anyone but Rastel himself. And so I'm sure that he didn't make up these stories.
No.
He got them from all over the place, probably from conversations and letters to friends and from books that he read. And some of them you can identify sources for. But he wrote them down, and he wrote them down probably always with an eye to publication. So they have a particular style to them. It's a bit of a sort of rambling style.
The one thing that touched me as a storyteller myself was the use of and to propel events forward a lot.
Yes.
Yes. And is that peculiar to this, or is that peculiar to him, or is that something found in other texts as well?
Well, it's not something I think that you'd find in Thomas More. So it's not something which the great stylists of the day would use. So in that sense, I don't honestly know. I'm not a, you know, I think you'd need to do a sort of concordance thing.
Yes.
And I don't have the knowledge to really answer that properly. But yeah, one of the things that I feel about the style is that as an oral style,
mm.
it actually works well.
Yes.
Yes. And if you imagine as well, if you imagine the voice of a stand-up comic
mm.
reading it.
Yes.
Which is a particular sort of pattern of oral delivery,
mm.
then it actually works in that style quite well too. And I think that's really interesting, that here you've got someone who might be reflecting a kind of pattern of speech that is designed for delivering jokes in a particular way that doesn't necessarily work perfectly on the page, but I think it does work. And as I say, it's usually described as being kind of a bit rambling and so on, and Rastel was a lawyer, and so he has that kind of legalistic style, but it is a style that's suited to oral delivery. A few years ago, I did a book of Norse myths, and I wanted to have a distinctively sort of oral style to them.
Mm.
And so every story in the book, I recorded oral performances. So I would tell it at least twice.
Mm.
So there's always two oral performances behind it. And I found that a really interesting exercise. It's an incredibly long-winded way of writing a book. I wouldn't advise it. But yeah, so every story in that book, every word in that book is really hard won.
Mm.
But I think it was a good approach for that, because in a way similarly to the Rastel thing, when I read the original Icelandic version of the myth, then it's a very oral style
mm.
that's coming through. It kind of reads as quite sparse, but you don't notice that when there's someone actually talking to you. It doesn't have that feeling. And I think in a way that's what's going on with Rastel. I love the style of Rastel. I have to, you know, I find it incredibly appealing. When I discovered 100 Merry Tales, it was as if I discovered that I had a slightly batty old uncle that used to sit in his chair and kind of tell stories. The rambling story is quite funny. And then a bit later on, you learn that he was born in the Middle Ages. And, oh, yes, well, that's fair enough. And that's, I suppose that's my relationship with 100 Merry Tales. It sort of brings this period to life in a way, where you kind of feel these people are within reach. They're obviously, you know, there's someone telling ridiculous stories about them, but the stories reflect a reality through a particular perspective on that reality. That's why I find it exciting.
You can think, well, the seed of truth, that something similar probably happened, but I think in the telling it's got slightly bigger and exaggerated in the way that stories do.
Yes, I think it's many of them, I think. Many of them just wouldn't be stories unless there was a seed of truth behind them, because they don't work unless you are willing to believe that it might not be true in every detail, but basically, you know, there was this conversation between a young woman and a young gentleman, and she outwitted him. And it's that sort of ability to believe in it that makes it work. And I think it's that made it work for the person telling it as well. You know, you wouldn't actually want to tell these unless you thought you were representing something that had truth in it.
And you mentioned that you might be, or you were thinking of maybe doing some readings or a tour of some description. Is that still a thought, or do you have any firm plans in that front?
It's a thought. I'd like to go around the country taking 100 Merry Tales, talking about them, talking about John Rastel, and telling some of the stories from the book. So far, I haven't got as far as organising anything on that, but it's definitely an idea that I'm looking at. And so that would be visiting a variety of different places, so from libraries to country houses, maybe some universities, you know, a variety of different venues. I even thought of trying to take it to a comedy club or two.
Yeah.
Seeing what happened.
Would you do that just on spec, as just on one of the a sort of open mic night, and just not advertise it, or do you warn people in advance?
I think it would probably be most sensible to, having done a couple of open mic nights quietly, to then, you know, take it out and maybe not build as such, but, you know, a definite slot with the organisers. I don't know any organisers of comedy clubs, and it might take a bit of persuasion for them to try 500-year-old jokes.
Let's do, if you'd like to do a quick plug of the book, of where we can find it.
Well, 100 Merry Tales, the Shakespeare Jest book, is available from all good bookshops and from Amazon and other online retailers. There are three different ways you can buy it. You can buy it as a hardback for $18.99, as a paperback for $12.99, or as a Kindle for $6.99.
And if you'd like to hear John reading some of Rastel's stories, if you have a venue, if you run a comedy night, and fancy some 16th century stand-up, then speak up now and I'll pass it on. I want to hear it. The second half of our discussion follows shortly, but first, I should mention that you can support the Beyond Shakespeare podcast on Patreon, www.patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. If you want to hear full cast audio adaptations of early English, early modern drama, then just by giving $1 a month, or for my UK listeners, that's currently about 77p, though exchange rates vary, you get early access to new audio, tickets to live shows, and more. More importantly, depending on what you give, you get voting rights to choose our next season for us. Basically, you can co-opt our production base. The current poll is now open, so get pledging now to get your vote in. You have a week and a bit from the time of this recording. Currently, patrons are enjoying a full cast audio of the Kane section of the Chester Mystery Cycle. It's based on some of our early recordings from nearly 5 years ago, and is very much a bonus ball to our normal output. Here's a little preview of the sort of thing we used to produce.
The best beast has mote I thee, of all my flock with heart free, to thee offered it shall be. Receive, Lord, my present. High God and King of bliss, now soothly I know well by this, my sacrifice accepted is before the Lord today. A flame of fire send thou has from heaven on high into this place. I thank thee, Lord, of thy grace, and so shall I do aye.
Out, out! How have I spent my good? To see this sight, I wax near wood. A flame of fire from heaven stood on my brother's offering. His sacrifice I see God takes, and mine refuses and forsakes. My semblant for shame shakes for envy of this thing.
To get more, pledge today at www.patreon.com, and that's Patreon, Patreon, /Beyond Shakespeare, and get those bonus features. And now let's return to my chat with John Thor Ewing, where we talk more generally about John Rastall, his career as a printer, and a little bit about his surviving play, The Four Elements. We're talking more generally now, and then we talk about Rastall's problem with the Welsh.
One of the things that I find really striking about John Rastall is that he seems to be a genuinely good man.
Mm.
You know, and that's something, you know, he gets into legal scrapes and, you know, he's not entirely selfless. But it seems to be a recurrent theme in his work that he wants to do something good. I think that's why he embarked on his legal publication, which now, of course, you know, they're acknowledged as being very important, but no one really reads them because, no. You know, they're no longer relevant.
Mm.
But they, you know, they are incredibly important that, you know, he put English law into English and put it there for ordinary people to read. And we can't really conceive of our world without that. And we owe it to Rastall. And there's, you know, various other things where you think, actually, this is someone who's trying to do his best. I think, for instance, the fact that Rastall begins writing pro-Catholic texts and then decides he was wrong and switches to Protestantism. Now, obviously, if you're a Roman Catholic, that probably doesn't seem like a very good thing. But I can't imagine that he did it politically. You know, maybe he did, but it just doesn't seem to make sense to me. And because he, you know, his friends and family remained loyal Catholics, and he himself went off on this big Protestant thing, which he obviously didn't profit by.
No. I was going to say, post the Reformation, his it doesn't go desperately well for him at all.
It doesn't go well, but you know, it's difficult to know quite why that is, because he falls in with Thomas Cromwell. So, you know, that could be good. I mean, Thomas Cromwell seems to have been a bit fickle when it comes to Rastall, at any rate. But, you know, he did kind of involve Rastall in some good things. He also involved him in a disastrous mining venture, which may have contributed to Rastall's downfall. But it wasn't really Cromwell's fault in that he didn't know it was going to go wrong. But Rastall got printing contracts through Cromwell, and when he died, he was arguing for another printing contract. Now, it may be that he would never have got that. So he wasn't, you know, he wasn't sort of completely ruined by the Reformation.
No, you get the impression it was a mixture of ill health as well. And
I think it was probably mainly old age, and he seems to have been put in prison either for refusing to pay something to the government or for his anti-tithes. He was against tithes because it meant that people didn't fulfill their charitable obligations, I think was his position.
his play, The Four Elements, it is very much that educational streak comes through again.
Yes, I think he was interested in educating people. I imagine that he would have felt that the communication of truth was inherently good, and that law went along with that, and sort of right living, understanding of the world, it's all part of the same pattern that is inherently just and godly, and that, you know, all these things which might nowadays be considered as separate for Rastel would not have been so obviously separate. And I think the Merry Tales, one of the points about that that would have been important to Rastel is that most of the Merry Tales have some kind of instructive element in them. And so there's a little bit that you learn as you go through the book, and it kind of reinforces certain messages. Not necessarily just one tale for each idea, but as you complete the book, then you've definitely got a sense of certain things being right, appropriate ways to behave, and helping you to learn religious texts or the meanings of religious texts and that sort of thing. Debates about proper practice within the church are also aired. And so there's, you know, there's a definite educational value in 100 Merry Tales too. I think there's something that he says in The Four Elements, because some folk be little disposed to sadness, but more to mirth and sport. This philosophical work is mixed with merry conceits to give men comfort and occasion to cause them to resort to hear this matter, whereto, if they take heed, some learning to them thereof may proceed. And that could be a description of what the Merry Tales are all about, too.
Yes.
It's all very jolly, but by the end of the book, you'll have learned something.
Actually, just on the Four Elements again, I particularly love about it is in the introduction, where it just points out that, you know, if you don't have much time, if you cut some of the longer, slightly more, the sad matter, I just love it. If you may leave out much of the sad matter as the messenger's part, you know, in the sense of the serious matter, and you can get an out of play that's an hour and a half down to 45 minutes. I think many playwrights should put that at the front of their work. I think that's a very important message to say.
Yes. Although I've seen Pinter performed without the gaps, which is...
gets the running time down. So he built his own theatre, or he repurposed a theatre in, what, Finsbury Fields, where he was residing?
Yes. I think it was probably the theatre that had been used for royal performances just before that, and he had it taken down and reassembled outside his house at Finsbury Fields. And yes, that's the first purpose-built public theatre, or permanent public theatre, that there ever was in England, or since Roman times, I suppose, when it wasn't really England. So it is it's an important beginning for English theatre, that, I think.
And there is this, you know, there's so much dramatic activity happening around court at the time. Do we know if John did any acting himself, or was he more sitting back and being producer and writer and publisher?
Nobody actually knows. I think he was closely involved in plays, and one of the stories that is in the Merry Tales tells about a stage play in Sussex. And I think what he's talking about there is going on tour with plays and with players, but they have to use local actors as well for some of the roles. And so this is one of the local actors who is all dressed up as the devil. He goes home to his own village, where, of course, he is mistaken for the devil and the consequences that follow from that. But I think Rastel must have been involved in theatre. He wrote plays, he published plays. Haywood, of course, his son-in-law, was also a playwright. And in those days, it seems to me, if you're writing plays, you don't stand back.
No.
And Rastel had his finger in so many artistic pies.
Well,
the idea of him not performing seems odd to me.
It's just that group or grouping or that interrelatedness of Moore, Rastall, Hayward, or even take it back to Medwall, I suppose. You know, in that early half of the 16th century, all really busy, active men of letters and learning and performance, and it's all that melee you were talking about, that golden age of activity, before it all gets much more complicated.
Yes, well, there is a sense that they're kind of they're just starting things off, and it's difficult. Maybe it's because we inevitably think of Shakespeare.
You have mentioned his name.
We think, oh, well, these people are precursors of Shakespeare. Whereas, of course, you know, you could also look at them as inheritors of 15th century stuff. But it does distort our perspective, probably. But nonetheless, I think even taking that out of the equation, I think there is a sense that something new is getting going with Moore and Rastall and Hayward and all of them. It really does feel like a new beginning to me, anyway.
We didn't even get on to did Rastall like the Welsh?
Yes. He's an interesting attitude to the Welsh. I don't know if he dislikes them. I suspect he spent some time in Wales, because when people generally give an account of Rastall's life, they have him sitting around in Ireland for a long time, because, you know, he goes off on this adventure to the New World, gets as far as Wexford, and then apparently stays in Ireland for a year, which seems unlikely to me. You know, I'm sure he would have hung around a bit and explored, but in a sense, maybe even I'm using 100 Merry Tales as my evidence subconsciously, that there's one story about Ireland and there's all these stories about Wales. And, you know, the obvious route back, if you've got no money to get back from Ireland, is to get a passage across to Wales and then walk. And, you know, I see no reason why he wouldn't have done that. If I do the dangerous thing of trying to imagine what I would do in his position, then I think that's what I would do. I'd work my passage to Wales and then walk home. And that way, you'd keep meeting Welsh people. It would be a bit of a dangerous and worrying environment. And, you know, with his interest in the law, and he's always interested in churchmen, actually, but he does seem to often have churchmen involved. But the places that I would go to stay would be with, it would be with ministers of local churches, because, you know, they'd put you up. There'd kind of be no question in my mind about whether they'd put me up if I was in his position then. And so that's how I'd get back to London. And it would be a really interesting journey. And I wonder whether that's what lies behind all those Welsh stories.
It's interesting, actually, in the Four Elements, when the whichever character it is discusses going around the globe or the various countries, doesn't actually mention Wales.
No.
Doesn't mention Wales. Does England, Scotland, you go across the coast to Ireland, and then does, I think, pretty much the rest of the planet. But I don't think it includes Wales. I could be wrong on that. That's just something I in passing was flicking through earlier, and I thought,
are they visiting? I wonder if he's thinking of visiting different realms.
I suppose in that logic it wouldn't
Wales
be
to be part
would be
of the
part
same
of England.
Realm of England.
That's a good thought. Haven't done Four Elements yet. It is on the list.
Four Elements does have a tricky song in it. Wonderfully, there is the music for the Four Elements.
Yes, I mean it's such a novelty for
but
us.
It's not very easy to perform.
No.
I do kind of historical music, and my wife is more that way inclined than me. But you know, she looked at it and said, "Oh, that's a bit odd, isn't it?" there are some peculiar features to it that, you know, that don't help even for people that, you know. It does work. It seems to me to work musically, but
it requires effort.
It's not straightforward.
Yeah.
Then there's another Robin Hood song that is extraordinary. I pondered how would you perform that, and I've kind of got an idea, because it's obviously the point of it is that it's all the Robin Hood ballads and just lines pulled out at random, or you know, something that sounds as if it would fit in a Robin Hood ballad, and just strung together as meaningless dribble. I think it's brilliant, actually.
I think it's probably time to round off and say, in 10 seconds or less, just sum up Merry Tales and Rastall and anything you want to say about why they're fantastic and amazing.
Well, I think the Merry Tales is really a classic of English literature that's been overlooked. It's the first English jest book, and by the end of Elizabethan times, it was still far and away the most popular English jest book. And it's cited by Dekker, Shakespeare, many other writers. It was read to Queen Elizabeth on her deathbed. It was just an incredibly celebrated work, and it's a charming and entertaining read.
Excellent. Well, thank you very, very much for your time. It's been lovely chatting to you.
Yes, it's been good to chat to you.
Yes. And that's it for this week. Do go out and buy the 100 Merry Tales. It's a really accessible route into 16th century popular thought. And it's a fun book to boot. Next week we'll be releasing the Cain play to the general podcast public, and there'll be more updates on Patreon. If you can support the work, then let me repeat it now. Do pledge something today. That's www.patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. And I'll leave you with the reason for one of the odd jumps in the audio earlier in the podcast. Eagle-eared listeners... No, not sure that works. Rabbit-eared listeners will have noticed a slight odd jump in the sound during a discussion of the history of the text. Here's what happened.
Sometimes I call the German 19th century scholar, whose correct name is Oesterli, sometimes I call him Oestermeyer by mistake. And so in case I call him Oestermeyer, maybe you could do something about that.
I can indeed. If you want to just say Oesterli several times in slightly different ways.
Oesterli. Oesterli.